and we've romanticized it and literized it, literaryized it, or given it literary expression. Please cut the word literaryized out of it.
No, that's absolutely in there. That's the title of the episode. Literary Eyes. In 1932, the author Aldous Huxley published the novel Brave New World. Since then, it's gone on to become a literary staple, one of the novels that you're supposed to have read, and it appears on various lists of the best novels of the 20th century, and even on some lists of the best novels of all time. Now, why is this? Why do some people feel so gripped by Brave New World? I'm Alex Racy, and here with me is John Farrell. Hey, John.
Hello, sir.
Good to be back with you.
Indeed.
We had a long time away from the podcast. And now just to lift the curtain and let listeners find out how things work behind the scenes, it turned out that in this case, it was a total screw-up. You thought you were waiting on me to schedule a podcast.
That's right.
And I thought I was waiting on you.
But that was only the last stage in our delay.
What caused the rest of it?
Well, just mere...
Normal incompetence,
right. Distraction, complications of life.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when it finally seemed as if things might work out, yet one more glitch.
Right. I showed up last time to do a podcast without the recorder for the podcast.
And that was the end of that.
Yeah. But here we are.
Here we are.
And there's more chaos behind the scenes because, as listeners will know, we normally don't plan out our podcasts. We certainly don't script them in any way. But this time, there's a special level of unplannedness.
Indeed.
Because I have asked you two times what this podcast is about. And I don't know if you remember this. The first time I said, what are we going to talk about? And you said, we'll talk about the book. And then I said, but look, what if we end up just repeating the plot to people? And you said, well, I think people like that.
I think they do, actually.
So I asked my wife about that, by the way, who says that that's absolutely true because it makes people feel like they've read the book.
Indeed.
And then, but I wasn't satisfied and I asked you again, what are we going to talk about? And again, you said, we'll talk about Brave New World.
Well, we'll talk about the issue, kinds of issues that it raises, the themes.
Right.
That are... central to it, and what kind of a book it is. Is it good?
Okay. Sounds like you have a plan. I'll let you guide the podcast.
Well, you know, I'm a professor of literature, so I'm...
I've heard that.
I know basically how these things go, sort of.
Right. So should we start by telling people about the book and what the plot is? Do you want to try that? You want me to try that?
I'd love to hear how you did it.
Okay. It's actually... a kind of hard book to summarize, I think.
It is, yes.
Maybe the place to start is actually not by describing the plot, but by describing the setting, right? So
indeed.
It's set many hundred years in the future, and we're led to believe that almost all people on the planet Earth are citizens of the world state, which is a kind of autocracy or dictatorship, but it's supposed to be at least quasi-benevolent. In the sense that it was started because there were these horrible wars on the planet that threatened planetary destruction. And the world state seems to have decided that this all arises because of certain, I guess you might say, flaws in human nature, which they're going to try to fix. And at the same time, they're going to try to make human beings happy, by which they seem to mean something like make human beings feel pleasure. So what's happening, right, is that the world state is now using various techniques to bring this about. And it's a long list, but here are a few. First of all, they manipulate fetuses as they grow them, because they grow them in a lab. And they do this in order to make people seemingly sort of content with their station in life. So if people are going to have a kind of mind-numbingly boring job, they basically make sure the person's brain is underdeveloped so that they don't feel frustrated in that job. They also use sleep hypnosis, which is a kind of brainwashing that happens while you're asleep. I guess another big thing the world state does is it's basically eliminated the conventional family because the idea is that the family is a source of neuroses. It's very Freudian.
That's right.
And then the thing everybody remembers, right, the most significant thing is they use this drug Soma. They basically drug people up whenever they're unhappy. And Soma has, I don't know, it's supposed to be maybe like being really high on pot or something like that. So, that's the world state. That's part of the setting. The other part of the setting is there are at least a few places on Earth that are not like that. The one that comes up in the novel is there's a Native American reservation where they seem to live by sort of what we would consider to be, for our purposes, the normal way of living.
In New Mexico.
In New Mexico, yeah. And it'll turn out that one of our heroes, John, who's sometimes called John the Savage by people in the world state, because they think of this lifestyle outside the world state as savage, he seems to be, I mean, he's not Native American. He's the child of two people from England, but he's grown up on this Native American reservation for reasons we'll probably talk about.
Indeed.
How's that for the setting? I didn't even get past the setting.
Excellent.
So do you want to try the plot? Because that's harder.
Well, I want to go on with the setting a little further, I think. Actually.
Okay.
And because you set out the regime of the world state. But what you haven't, there's a couple of other things to touch on that really give a sense of the tone with which this is all presented. And one of them is that there's an enormous amount of sloganeering that is part of everyday life here. And people are really are being conditioned at all times in many different ways. Not just the sleep conditioning, but they're being encouraged in every possible way not to have anything personal of themselves. So there's a kind of continuous and obligatory promiscuity that is central to the way people live in the world state. Everybody belongs to everybody else, as the slogan goes.
Right.
So because everybody belongs to everybody, no one gets personally attached to anyone. So the world state has eliminated the family structure, and we now deliver everybody in test tubes, or we decant them.
Right.
People are not born, they're decanted. And that's a humorous, that gives you a sense of the humorous tone of the book. And then once you grow up, you never delay having sex with anyone, because everybody will have sex with you. And so you don't really care about anybody. In fact, you're discouraged from having too many encounters with any one person. And that would suggest a personal connection. And so there's been a very subtle and very total kind of re-engineering of people's basic attitudes towards each other on just about every level. So Freud is one of the main models of it. He provides you the kind of account of human motivation. But the other person that is the god of this world is Ford.
Right, Henry Ford, yeah.
Henry Ford. And when people swear, they say, they don't say, by our Lord, they say, our Ford. And so Ford is the god of this world, and it's all about mass production. Mass producing not just the objects that people consume, but people themselves. People have been mass produced, standardized, and designed for the task they perform. So Huxley's responding to mass production, to mass culture, the rise of mass culture, the movies. Movies are another way in which people are kept in place. They've invented something that goes beyond movies. And, of course, Huxley's writing this in 1932, so the talkies are only 5 years old.
Right.
When the book came out. So he's added a new idea, that the feelies. Not only hear people talk, but you can feel them in the movie. So there's been a new technological advance to make movies even more compelling. So mass production is another, mass culture is another element, and you may well feel that it's just as important as the other means of keeping people controlled. So it's all very kooky and jokey and funny, because people have been reduced to these simple contraptions, and they go about their lives utterly tranquilized in every possible respect. And Huxley presents this with a good deal of detachment and makes fun of it. So that's one of the elements of the book. And if you just take that part of it and think about what it says about the world as we now exist in it, it's a kind of dystopia, obviously, because nobody would want to be an engineered creature in a world like that.
Yeah.
But of course, in our world, it's based upon, first of all, Huxley's experience of American mass culture and mass production and so on. And we've taken all these things to further levels since he was around. And many people have thought of modern culture as just this kind of thing. This grand regime of conditioning and dulcification, pleasurizing everything. You know, how aren't we really just ourselves very much like the characters that are described in the book? That's sort of Huxley's main contribution to the conception of unhappiness, is to present you with a vision of unacceptably unfree and undignified life, which is nevertheless in the image of happiness.
So that's all still setting. We haven't done the plot.
So the plot revolves around someone who did not grow up in the world state. His name is John Savage, and he's grown up on this Indian reservation in New Mexico. His mother was someone who grew up in the world state and was conditioned to expect promiscuity and to be horrified by the notion of actually giving birth to someone, which for the denizens of the world state has come to seem something unimaginably obscene. So that's the kind of upbringing that John Savage had. Another element of his upbringing is that, of course, he doesn't have an education in either in the world state sense or in our sense. What it is, he has been learned to read, and the one text that he's had available to him is the works of Shakespeare.
Right.
So he's read the works of William Shakespeare.
So what he knows of love or sexuality or things like that, a lot of it comes from his impressions that he gets from Shakespeare.
Yes. In fact, it's what he knows about everything. God, sex, death. So one of the characters from the world state, at a certain point in the story, goes to the reservation and recognizes that Savage's mother was a long-lost woman who had gone up to the reservation and never come back. And he also meets the young man, Savage. He's grown up now, and he's in contact with this other character, and they wind up taking John and his mother back to where she originally came from, which is England. And John is introduced to the culture of the world state. So we get to see what happens when you take a person who's grown up in the old way, in a family, and has a certain kind of traditional education, which is education in Shakespeare. What's going to happen to him when he enters that strangely anesthetized environment of the world state? And of course, it's a very unhappy situation for him. Because, for one thing, he has ordinary human needs. For instance, love. He'd like to be in love with someone. And he'd like to have sex, of course. But the women that he meets in the world state, they will all have sex with him. And without any preliminaries at all. Without it meaning anything. Because they're like sex machines. And this is deeply disturbing to him. He can't enjoy it at all. He simply falls in love with someone that he meets, but is utterly contemptuous of her because of her behavior. And then he finds no sympathy in that world for his sympathetic relationship with his mother, which is intense, and he sees his mother retreating back into the world of Soma and basically more or less killing herself with Soma because there's nothing else for her to do in that world. So she dies, and he feels deeply disturbed by that. So Savage, he's fascinating to the people in the world state because they get to observe this other kind of creature. But he can't adjust. And so in the end, he winds up trying to go out into nature again on his own. But it's very much like a person who's gone viral in our world. The press pursues him out there. And in the very final scene, he winds up in a confrontation with the press and with Lenina and with other pleasure seekers who are curious about him. And Huxley doesn't exactly say what happens then, but their tendency to join into everything and to be communal in every way seems to help them enter into his frenzy, and he enters into theirs. And then we're told that Savage wakes up the next morning after a night of passion. And it seems like a kind of orgy has occurred. And immediately after that, he hangs himself. So,
spoiler alert.
I'm sorry, that was... that's the strangest of the book, that Savage is such a unexpected kind of counterpoint to the world state. So we'll have to choose. Is it better to be a person who's been administered, whose wife has been administered, to be pleasurable on all occasions, even though trivial? Or is it better to be the kind of neurotic individualist that is that Savage proves to be? So what do you think about that? Is that a kind of question we should ask at the end of the book?
I suppose, but look, to start with a very simple point.
Okay.
A strange thing about this book is that as you're reading it, you think it's going to be a presentation of alternate worldviews.
Yes.
And some kind of adjudication between them.
Right.
But the alternate worldview to the world state is a person who has been raised on a Native American reservation where he wasn't accepted, right? So he gets beaten up by all the kids and so on. And he's sort of a socially isolated, doesn't really get what you and I would consider to be a normal upbringing, plus the works of Shakespeare. And that's a very odd alternate point of view because, you know, the first simple reaction you have as a reader is, well, of course I don't like either of those. I think I'll take something more like we have now. So it's a strange question because I think you're sort of tempted as a reader to kind of reject it and feel like, well, of course I don't know how I would choose between these two things, but it's a strange false dichotomy, right?
Well, I think that's the way many readers would now take it. But I think that for somebody like Huxley and his generation, being educated by the works of Shakespeare was not as cranky a situation as you might think it to be. And when we see John Savage growing up on the reservation, the main feature of that I think is meant to be relevant is that he has a real relationship with his mother, and that produces all the neuroses that psychoanalysis predicted. So I think that you're making Savage's past sound too aberrant and too arbitrarily out of the way than it would have, more so than it would have seemed to Huxley and his generation.
I mean, I guess what you're saying, I sort of see your point, is that maybe I'm not supposed to focus on some of the strange things that he believes or does that he seems to be taking literally from Shakespeare. He's supposed to be more representative of the person who has normal human neuroses or something like that.
That's right.
Yeah.
I didn't get to the main conversation, which I think is the crux point of the novel that we'll have to talk about. The place where the book really comes to a point and to a head is the point when John Savage finally gets to meet with the main administrators of the world state.
Right.
His name is Mustafa Mond. The climax of the novel is this confrontation between him and Savage. And what we discover is that Mond is not the kind of sinister genius that you might have thought of as the designer of a thing like this. But rather, he's a rather sophisticated intellectual who himself has read Shakespeare and knows about science and history. He has access to all the riches of past culture, which everybody else in the world state lacks. And his original desire for his own life was to be a scientist, which, by the way, was Huxley's own original desire for himself. He wasn't able to pursue science because he had very, very bad eyesight. And so he wound up being a writer, unlike just about all the other members of his family. And it was a very famous science family. So Mond wanted to be a scientist, but the world state doesn't really need science. Because science, although it uses science in a very broad way, it can't really afford the kind of instability that can come from uncensored and unrestrained research. It can't afford the kind of instability that comes from knowing about the past. One of Henry Ford's famous quotations, he probably didn't actually say it, at least not very straightforwardly, was one of his famous sayings was, "History is bunk." And the idea was basically, I don't need to know about the past. We're redesigning the world to be the thing that Americans need right now. So Mond is a person who fully appreciates all the things that Savage is missing in this world. But what he tells him is, well, what you want is the right to be unhappy. Because having high art and science and knowledge of history in the past and deep personal relationships and God and all of those things that you read about in Shakespeare, all those things are incompatible with the kind of stability that allows us not to be at war, not to be having constant chaos and crisis. And so it's not worth it. That's the argument. And in that conversation, Savage is not a crank Shakespearean robot. Right? He's someone who puts a powerful case against Mond.
I'm surprised that you say that you think John does a good job of presenting the opposite side of things. Maybe this is where I'm being sort of simple-minded again, but I was thinking, actually, part of the problem with John being the representative of the other side of things is that, again, he has this weird sort of abridged understanding of the world, and so he actually can't give even the kind of elementary defense of an alternate vision of the world that you would get from somebody who had, like, even high school social studies in the U.S., right? I mean, he's not capable of talking about basic ideas like human beings having rights or democracy or the right to autonomy to control your own life. So why did you, I'm curious about why you think he does a good job on the other side of things.
Because he's pointing to what he thinks are the sources of human dignity. Love, I mean, if freedom is involved, right? And those are just, what you're talking about are some of the means to those things. But this is a more, it's a more deeply principled kind of complaint that he makes. Basically, we don't really want to be happy if we have to sacrifice freedom completely, right? Nothing in this world costs enough, he says. And that is that to me is a very striking way of putting it. And, you know, a more pragmatic and realistic kind of politics would just not be, I don't think, wouldn't have the same weight in this situation.
So can you say more about why you think this is a great way of phrasing things when John says nothing here costs too much? Because it is again, you know, maybe it's because I do political philosophy. It
yes.
is not the way I would explain to somebody like Mustafa Mond
right.
what has gone wrong in the world state. I wouldn't say that things don't cost enough. In fact, I've never been sympathetic to this complaint. So this comes up all the time in philosophy.
Yes.
People will say, the reason we have to have so much misery in human life is it makes us appreciate the good. And I've never bought that at all. I think even if things didn't cost so much and life were happy, that would be just fine. So why do you think this is like an insightful way to respond to some sort of dictatorial figure who wants to drug up his population?
Well, let me say this. I don't think it's either side of this equation is an adequate kind of political position, right? But if you think that modern life is becoming utterly without purpose and meaning because you don't believe in anything more than just passing a pleasant day from one day to the next, if that is not adequate to you, then and you see everyone around you simply drugging up to be happy and that's what it's all based on, then, in a sense, nothing costs enough, right? That seems to be the nothing actually to strive for in an environment of that sort. And that is a classic kind of humanistic complaint about mass culture and its entertainments and so on, that it evacuates the initiative and purpose of life.
Right, so now this is actually useful because you're sort of essentially connecting up this speech with the reflections we're supposed to be led to about modern culture. So
yes.
Here's the way I'm understanding you. So suppose that we do think modern culture in some way or other is similar to the world state. I mean, we don't live in a dictatorship where they basically forcibly drug us. But, you know, usually people say the analog is something like, well, but there's corporate propaganda and there are people encouraging you to be nothing but a consumer and spend your life as a worker bee earning money that you can spend on more products. Okay, so that's the usual sort of analogy. And what you're saying is something like, look, if that's what worries you, not just about the world state, but about real modern life, maybe a decent way to explain what's missing from modern life is something like, we don't really strive for anything. Is that the idea?
Yes.
But is that right? I mean, I feel like people strive for things all the time. I mean,
oh, sure they do.
Yeah. So is that really what's gone wrong?
Well, I don't think so myself, but.
Yeah.
I mean, it is the entertainment industry, which is highly manipulative also, the routine of mass consumption, Henry Ford's desire to engineer workers to be happy with the cars and so on, and Ford and Disney and people like that from that period did have very grand ideas about how you could reorganize all of life so that everyone would fit perfectly into this economic structure. And their desires and their goals and their customs would be rationalized to fit the economic purpose that they served. There is something frightening about that.
Yeah, see, so maybe we're getting to the heart of why I don't see this response by John Savage to be so insightful. It may just be because I see modern culture and its problems differently from the way you do or the way people do if they want to see this novel as having some sort of parallel to the modern world. So you ran a couple of things together, for example, that I would want to pull apart, right? So you mentioned the entertainment industry, which is endlessly trying to entertain us with shows and movies and so on.
Right.
I actually think that's terrific. I think, you know, one of life's great joys is storytelling in all its forms. And, you know, look, there's a lot of bad television, but there were a lot of bad plays written in Shakespeare's day. This isn't a problem of modern industry. It's just hard to write good stories and most people are bad at it, right? But, you know, a great TV show produced by Netflix or HBO, whatever, I think that's fantastic. So I would want to pull that apart from some other things. And it
yes.
could just be that if we tunnel down on all of this, I'm just not as agitated by the parts of the modern world that many people think are oh so similar to the world state. And so I don't really feel the force of these alleged critiques of it because I don't even think it needs critiquing. I mean, actually, can I ask for your scholarly knowledge here? So I realize that when I am thinking about the alleged parallels between the problems of the world state and the problems of our current world,
yes,
I'm sort of taking a guess about what people have said those parallels are, but it's not like I've actually read people who've written about this. So, I mean, here's a way to think of it. So to take the aspects of the world state we mentioned in our when we were describing its basic features.
Yes.
For the people who see parallels, at least vague parallels between the world state and our present society, what do they think is the equivalent of Soma, the drug that everybody takes that just gets them high all the time? I mean, is it just that they think people in our society use drugs? Is that the parallel?
Well, I'm not sure that there are people who are writing and trying to find immediate and direct links.
Yeah.
I think it's really a kind of general sense of it's often contrasted with 1984, right? And Orwell's vision of 1984 is that a dictatorship will take over and it will use absolute violence to compel people to do what it wants them to do and find ways of breaking them and humiliating them to the extent that they try to dissent. And Orwell's the narrative of that book says that if you want to picture this, all you have to do is picture a boot stomping on a face forever. So it's a direct form of control that Orwell was warning about. And of course he sees this in Soviet communism. And the contrast is made with Huxley that what he suggests is that control can be done in a much softer way. That it can be done by giving people a lot of what they want. And manipulating them that way. So that's a large part of the way the book has been discussed. That to me is also very simple, because this coercion in both cases in the book, and this even and Orwell also has, the opiate to the masses and give the people sporting events and beer and all of that for the ordinary folk. So they're not absolutely different in that way. But I can't really give you a really interesting sense of the way that people have made the comparison. They haven't pursued it in that manner.
Well, but the reason we were thinking about that, right, is we were talking about, you know, does John have this great response to Mustafa Mann that offers some sort of insight? And I guess what you're saying is something like the critique is of something more general, just of the idea that we will be socially controlled, not through violence, but through the provision of pleasure or something like that. And that's what he's responding to and objecting to.
He is. I mean, I would not say that his response is political. He's not saying exactly what you would say, what I would say, I think, in this situation, which is, you know, you're controlling us every minute.
Right.
He's more responding to the kind of life that he's being offered, right, in that regime of control.
He's trying to say life is more, or good life is more than just pleasure.
Yes. And he wants something much grander than that.
Yeah.
And Mustafa Mon says happiness is never grand. So there again you have Huxley's strangeness, because I think that he shares the sense that Shakespeare's, the life of Shakespeare in literature is grander. It has dignity to it in a way that mere bourgeois happiness doesn't. But he makes Savage look foolish in the way that this plays out for him. Mustafa Mann seems more realistic when he says happiness is never grand and what you're asking for is the privilege of being unhappy.
So could you tell me more about what the alternative to the happy life is supposed to be? So it's easy to say, you know, one thing we want is to be able to strive for grand goals. That seems clearly true. That's part of human life. We like to do that. But the point is, what is, other than identifying the importance of striving and achievement,
yes,
what is there in the, what we could call Shakespearean view of life that's so insightful about what human beings should want out of their lives?
Well, it's simply a record of what human existence has been, you might say. Human existence has been conflict, struggle.
Yeah.
Everything that's what our life is now, right? It's still full of conflict, struggles, difficulties, irrationality, pain.
But most of those things are not things that we actually think are part of a good human life. They're just the unfortunate parts of human life.
Yes.
Like nobody would say, you can't have a good human life unless you kill someone or go to war.
No. But do we really want to be? Do we really want all of our problems to be solved so there's nothing for us to do?
Yeah, so this is
that's the basic problem.
This is the kind of question where I always have a different reaction from everyone else. I think, yes, we do. We do want our problems solved, right? I mean, because there's no shortage of problems, right?
Yes.
So we can get rid of war and we still have plenty of problems, right? We can get rid of whatever, serial killers, still plenty of problems.
But where do you get rid of all the problems? All of them?
Yeah, I guess I sort of lose my grip on what exactly is being said, right? Like, are you saying, for example, so let's suppose there's no more difficulty in life, right? So I don't have to, watch my relatives die anymore. Somehow that's been solved and so on. But are you saying there are literally no problems, like, as in, we can't play a chess game and I can't strive to be good at that or solve that kind of problem? I mean, are you imagining a society where there's no challenge? Because sure, that's rotten. Human beings would not enjoy that.
Right.
But that can't be the inside of the book, which is something like, you know, it can't just be something like we don't want to be drugged all day. That's true.
Yes.
But that better not be like the deep insight, because that's not that deep.
No one wants to defend unhappiness in the deep sense, right? And no one wants to say we really don't want to ultimately solve all these problems. And you're right that chess and other games, they do provide us with the kind of excitement and tension and possibility for happiness or unhappiness in any one game.
Yeah.
That life offers.
Right.
Right. What John is really saying is, I want life as it's always been. And the question is, you know, is we really be happy solving all the problems of life? And when you look at what we've done in the present, what life has always been is something that we're so deeply attached to. We've romanticized it and embedded it in grand literary experiences, so much so that we're more attached to that than we are to the possible results of an improved world. I mean, that was a very deep insight that Huxley has about that. It's a very deep tension. And it's something I haven't seen anywhere else put so pointedly. It's not that John's critique is the right one, but it's where it comes from. Wouldn't you really rather live in Shakespeare's world, where everyone speaks grandly and is grand? And you would say no, of course, and so would I. But there's a sense of loss with it.
candles were burning, and I took a boat to Ibiza, and I couldn't find you for days. You laid in the sun till you fainted. You slept in a bed that you painted, and I found myself in a